Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness this week. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Interesting guest today. We're going to talk about something other than quantum mechanics for a change. I've got Dr. Betty Kovacs with us, and we're going to talk about her book, The Miracle of Death, and the things that happened in her life to bring about this book. How are you, Betty?
I'm fine, thank you.
God, thanks for being with us. Like I said, I just got finished reading this book today, and whew, it's something else. It really is. So, first of all, why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about you and your path that you've been on and how you came to be where you are, and then we'll talk about your book.
Okay. Well, I was a teacher in college for many years. I taught mythology and literature, and I especially loved the mythology course, and so did the students, because it really allowed us to open up to images and dreams and visions and the dreams really of different world cultures. So I also taught, of course, then symbolic language. And students would say to me, you know, I want to tell you something that I've never told anyone else in my life. So they would start remembering and actually telling some of the experiences that they had had that they could never share with anyone. So, and they often said that the class was on Wednesday night, that after Wednesday night they would dream, and very vivid dreams, because we spent 3 hours talking about the dreams and myths of people of other cultures. So that was especially important to me, and I loved the class, and I loved the students, and our the connection that we had. But in my earlier life, I had always been looking for something beyond the material world. It just seemed to me there had to be something that I was not connected to. And that led me to study religions, and then mythology, and then shamanism. And I went to Peru, and I worked for a short time with a shaman from the Amazon, and then later one from the Andes. So what I was really looking for was direct experience. I was a person who couldn't believe. I had read Carl Jung and was deeply impressed with his work, and especially when he said, you know, there are those of us who simply cannot believe. And when we can believe, it's a good thing. But if we cannot believe, we have to have experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I was looking for. And I did begin to have powerful experiences once I went to Peru, and especially when I came home. But 2 years later, then my mother was killed by a car. And then 1 year later, my only child, my son, was killed in a car accident. And then a little more than 2 years later, my husband Istvan was killed in a car accident. But Istvan and I had such powerful experiences with Pishti's presence after his death that we were totally changed.
For my listeners, Pishti's your son.
Pardon me?
So my listeners will understand who you're talking about. Pishti was your son.
Yes, Pishti was my son, and Istvan, my husband.
And he had not been what we call a spiritual seeker, right?
My husband.
Mm-hmm.
No, he had always respected my struggle, but he himself was not involved in it. Oh, in the early years, we talked and explored things together, but then he was a businessman, and he became involved in his work and certainly supported me. But I remember one time trying to tell him an experience I'd had when I was in Peru, after I had returned from Peru, and he was reading the Los Angeles Times, and I realized I did not have this man's attention. And I said to him, Istvan, are you just not interested in these things? And he said, you know, I know that you have experienced what you're telling me, but I have never had any experience remotely similar, and I simply don't know how to relate to it. Well, it wasn't long until he was the one who was actually an anchor for me in the experiences of other dimensions.
So what happened? He had an awake vision of your son, right?
Well, a lot of it, well, 2 weeks before our son's death, my husband was in his office here at home, and he suddenly had a waking vision in which he saw our son's car just off the side of the freeway and Pishti's body superimposed on it. And he knew that he was dead because it was superimposed from another dimension. And he felt that, oh, that's right. It's almost time for you to do that. And that was so horrifying to him. But then he heard Pishti's voice say, "That's right, Dad. I'll be out of the house for a little while." And Ishvan had no idea what that meant, but it was so horrifying to him that he forgot it until the day the phone call came and we were both here and our son was in the trauma center and the hospital was calling us.
Then he remembered it. That he could forget something. I don't know that I could forget that.
It's interesting that it was his mind totally repressed it. But, you know, when I looked back at my journals, I realized that for 2 years, I had been dreaming of Pishti's death in various ways. I had always looked at them symbolically and not as his actual death. And I had dreams of intruder dreams in which something was trying to get through to me that I wouldn't let in. And then I would have a dream in which it did get in, and I had one dream in which I had written in my journal, "I have just received news of Pishti's death." And then it gets displaced onto another young man who's the son of a friend of mine. But in the dream, I mourn, I grieve deeply, but I just wasn't letting it in. But it's interesting how the mind can work to protect a person. And I think that we all had dreams, and yet we either looked at them symbolically or forgot them. And yet somewhere in us we knew, and we were being prepared for what was even grieving beforehand for what had happened.
What was your PhD in? Was it in this kind of work?
It was in comparative literature and symbolic mythic language, the theory of symbolic mythic language. And I had been teaching mythology quite a while before I went back to get my degree.
So it's interesting that you, of course, you would try to interpret it as being symbolic and not as what was really going to happen.
When it's something like that, well, I should say that when my son was not quite 12, he had a dream, and he told me his dreams because we talked about dreams and stories. And so one afternoon I was vacuuming, and he said, "Oh, Mom, I just remembered a dream I had." It's strange that he did not remember this until the afternoon, and it was a huge dream. And so I turned off the vacuum and sat down, and he said, "Will you write it down?" I did, and I found later that he had also written it in his journal and had drawn pictures of it. But his dream was he was in the trauma center, and he was up above the hospital looking down at what he said was his dead body. And he described the operating room he had been in detail, the different kinds of white and chrome and where the gurney was, where the wash basin was. And then he had a period of darkness, and then he was in a place that was complete peace and light. There was a circle of total light. And he said that there were 4 boys to his right, 4 boys to his left. He was the 5th, and he was looking across an eternal fire and saw the aura of a 10th one. And he said, "You know, we all knew that we were waiting for that 10th one to arrive, and I knew that when that person arrived, it would be me, and I would be complete."
Interesting. Now, what was your faith before all this happened?
Well, you know, I had studied various religions, but I couldn't believe. I saw very meaningful things in all of them, but I had to know from actual experience. And so we did not belong to any faith.
Wait, now that this has happened and you can look back, can you tell any difference between a dream that's symbolic and one that's predicting something?
You know, I think that that is sometimes the difficulty with that dreaming mind, is that it doesn't always let us know. Now, sometimes we have a definite feeling, but at other times it wants us to know and then to draw back from it so that we can know it but still live if it's something that we can't change. I think sometimes we can change things, and we know we can.
Mm-hmm.
But at other times, I think not. And I think that the symbol is multi-leveled and multi-layered, and there's so many ways of looking at it and experiencing it. And sometimes it is going to relate literally in the actual outer physical world, and sometimes it's something that's taking place in our psyche, and I think we can't always know.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about you and when you found out and how you dealt with that, because I know other people have it, and I'd like to give them some way to have hope and some strength to deal with it when it happens to them, because you've certainly been able to deal with it.
You mean the actual death?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, yes, it was just the thought earlier that I might ever lose that child would have just been unbearable. And I didn't really, really consider that I would, that he would really die. But when we got the news of the accident, I knew then, and I think that all of that had been going on in us in the dream world was all of that energy and that knowledge was with us. But I knew that something big was happening. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that, not so much that he would die, but that something big was going to happen. But I think that I know that what helped me and my husband Istvan was that we were connected. He did return. It was a day after his memorial. We were both here. It was Sunday. And we both had very powerful experiences with his presence.
At the same time, right?
Pardon me?
At the same time.
Yes, yes.
That's amazing.
And my husband had, that morning he said to me, I just wonder if someone could actually have a heart attack from sorrow. And I wanted him to go to the hospital, but he just wouldn't do it. I mean, we'd been there for 13 days with our son, and we lay down and listened to music. And sometimes music, you know, the vibration can take you into an altered mm-hmm. space. And we were so wide open. And we both did experience him. And, you know, people would say, well, how could you know that that was real? And I think of what Andrew Newberg said in his book, Why God Won't Go Away, is that it's realer than real. I mean, his presence was so strong. His consciousness was so much more expanded than it was when he was here. And the love was so present that it was deeply healing, just deeply healing.
Tell us about it so that they can at least try to relate. Tell us about what happened that day.
Well, my husband, after it was over, he said to me, Pishti was here. And I said, yes, he was. So Istvan then sat up and he said, you know, there's no way that I can even begin to put into words what happened. He said, I shot out of my body and flew through the universe at an enormous speed. And he was, you know, it was almost like someone dying when it was like this tunnel. And that was dark, and he was flying very quickly. And he saw at the end of the tunnel a light, a circle of light, and it was coming toward him. And as it approached, it was close enough for him to see. In fact, it became very close. He saw that it was Pishti, our son, in a yoga position holding the earth, and that's actually the icon that I have on the front of the book. I found this icon in a store afterwards, and I was so amazed because it looked exactly like our son to me. It did, his hair, his body, everything. But Istvan saw him, and he said that it was there was such silence and such a sense of love and the sense of that everything was sacred. He said that love, he thought, he knew that love was the key to everything, and he saw how much Pishti loved the earth itself and how the earth is a living being. And he said that Pishti had explained to him how respect allows us to be more conscious of love. But he said, I had never experienced respect like he did that day. He said it was a completely new meaning for him. He respected himself and everyone and everything to such a degree that the whole world was sacred. And I think that that was so much a core of our experiences, that it wasn't just that we were connecting with our son, but we were one. The whole universe is a part of us, and we are a part of it. And when any of us makes a connection or a breakthrough, it's one for all of us.
It
and
is,
that respect
it?
And that sense of unity was so intense that it was, he said afterwards, I will never look at the earth in the same way again. And he didn't.
Was your son different when he was alive?
He was, you know, I think about it now, and I take so many of the things that happened sort of for granted, but he did pay attention to his dreams, and he had some very unusual experiences. And
did he seem to have any psychic abilities? I mean, was he one of those different children?
He was, I wouldn't say that it was psychic ability. I think he was just tuned in to his own inner world, and that would mean the psyche, the universe, mm-hmm. too, in a way, much more than I was, because I had been so influenced by our culture as a rational way of life. Even though I consciously rejected that, I still had been brainwashed in that way. And I think he wasn't, and he was open to so much, and he did experience so much. But I wouldn't say that he was psychic, really.
Mm-hmm. It's just so interesting that he would come back to the two of you. Because I've had that experience with my parents since they passed away, but it's hard to imagine that they would come back to two people simultaneously at the same time. That's just amazing,
mm-hmm.
that it happened to you like that.
Well, you know, I think the timing and being wide open the day after his memorial, and we were exhausted from 13 days in the hospital, and so longing to understand, and that we gave it time. I think, you know, we simply lay down and put on music. And
were you angry?
No, I can't say that I ever was, and I don't think he was either. I never saw any anger from him. It wasn't anything we experienced. But I think that we had been prepared. My son had a dream during the year, actually, that he was killed. That was very, very powerful. And he told it to me while I was making cappuccino and he was getting milk. And I remember saying to him, oh, Pishti, that's big. We'll talk about it later, because we didn't have time then. And I totally forgot it. Just, it was strange. I forgot it. But we did find it in his notebook after he died. But he's actually experienced everyone in the house chanting and hundreds of candles lit, and everyone was chanting, and he was going back and forth out to the universe and back. He was actually experiencing dying, and I said to him in that dream what I actually said in the hospital, one of the things I said, which is, you must come back for the body. It's not looking good. You must come back. And he came back, and then I said, you were afraid, aren't you? And he said, no. So he got in the body on the bed and pulled up the sheet, and it was total light. And he shot out of his body and shot out into the universe. And he said he passed suns and worlds so fast that they popped as they went by. And so then he experienced the crash and the accident, and realized that, he said in the dream, he realized that that body was not him. It was had been reduced to a vegetable permanently. And then he woke up, but of course he was brain dead really, from the time of the accident. We just didn't know it.
How did it change your life, and how long did it take for any change to occur?
I think that it was quickly. It was always that sense of something big taking place. Even when he was in the hospital, I felt that it was, that there was an energy field that was much larger than I was. And then afterwards, well, even, you know, my husband had a vision in the hospital, as a matter of fact, when the doctor said to us one night, you know, we don't think that he's going to make it through the hour. And there were people there, many people upstairs, downstairs, and then my husband Ishwan and I were standing there just holding hands, and I suddenly looked up at him because I felt an energy coming from him that I thought he might explode. I mean, the energy was so powerful. And it was, he could not bear it. He just could not endure it, as that's what we always feel. But I don't know where I got my words, but I said, you know, Ishwan, if we are called to do this, we can do it. But during that time, during that hour, Ishwan had a very powerful vision, which I think really helped him to heal and put him on the track immediately. He saw our son standing on the smaller mountain, that Machu Picchu, and he was reaching up with one hand into the air, and he was handing what he got from up above, he was handing with the other hand down to his dad. And later, my husband said, I didn't know whether he was going to live or die, but there was such love and peace that I knew I could take anything. That whatever happened, it was exactly the way it needed to be. And so I think that that was a real beginning for him, and then the visions afterwards. And they lasted until my husband died. And then afterwards I had experiences with him, but they were different. They were not as intense, of course, as time went on. But I would say that within the first, even at the hospital, and then after the first visions, it's like the world was a totally different place. It was not at all how we had seen it before. And it was loving. And we knew that life and love are eternal. And we knew that. We just had so deeply experienced that.
I kind of get the impression from your book that you may have came away with some indications about what may come to be in the world. And I know your book doesn't focus on that, but I came away with that. Am I right, or am I making
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. It was interesting because Pishti sort of communicated to us that, you know, for several days in the hospital, he was very much on this side and didn't really want to cross over. And then when he realized what was going on, it said, yes, that's right. That's what I'm to do. And then he knew he had to help us to remember what we were doing and why we were here. But one of the things he said, and it was over a two-year period, but he talked a lot about the Earth. In fact, the Earth was central to every vision, that the Earth, he had said then, that was in 1991, that in the next 20 years are going to be some of the most difficult years that the Earth is going through, really profound transitional times. And we both experienced, my husband and I, that many souls had come to the Earth to help us through this transition, and that many, many people here are making the connection to Spirit and waking up. In fact, in one of the visions, the vision that I had the day after his memorial was that there was a great spiral of beings coming, and they were chanting, and they chanted, our brothers and sisters on the earth are dreaming a terrible dream.
That's the truth, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it? And it was this deep, deep sense of love from the universe that could come now and help us, because we were ready and had asked for that help, and we were ready for it, and we were going through this transition. He would often say, the mother, meaning the Mother Earth, is giving birth to a new child. And my husband felt that this new child would have a new ring of DNA and would be connected. If we did this work, if we did the work we are doing, and so many people are doing it in science and there's so many people who are having experiences that this is a gift to the new child. That child will be connected in ways that we are not.
Do you know if that's true yet?
If that's happening already?
That's the page that I marked in this book I wanted to ask you about. You talked about that new ring of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a statement here. We've abused our human freedoms. And then you follow that by, we must first know the causes of corruption before we can do away with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's necessary to be cautious during the time before the start. What does that mean to you?
Oh, that's from the I Ching. Well, one morning my husband woke up and he'd had a very powerful dream, but it was more like a vision. And it was this that you've just read. But what he said was, he said, do you have the I Ching? Well, he knew that years ago I did have it, and I said, I do.
Did he know what the I Ching was?
Pardon me?
Did he even know what it was?
He only knew because I had talked to him about it years ago, and we had thrown coins maybe once or twice, but that's it. And he had never talked about it, or he himself had never taken the book to read or do anything with. And it had been years. And I said, I do have it, but I'll have to find it in my study. And he said, please go get it. So I ran to get it, and then he said, look up the hexagram starting from the top. Well, you know, usually when you throw the coins, you start from the bottom. But he said, from the top, it's straight, broken, broken, straight, broken. And so, and he'd also been talking about some of the visions that I had had. And in his vision, the jackal, which had appeared in my visions, appeared to him. And the jackal is a wonderful Egyptian symbol of the dog who can see as well in night as in day, and also as a creature who buries his food until it rots. And when it's just at the right stage of rot, he digs it up and he eats it. And within his own body, he transforms it into new life. So Ishvan said the jackal was in this vision. And Pishti was talking to him. He said the jackal is a very powerful symbol for your time, our time, because what we have to do is to become conscious of this terrible dream, to all of the rot, it seems, decay is surfacing all over the world, and that we have to become conscious of it, take it in ourselves and transform it. Well, when Ishvan then told me to look up the hexagram, and I got the hexagram 18, which is work on what has been spoiled or decayed, neither of us could speak. We were so stunned. And my son had said to him, this is your work, meaning the two of us, and read it carefully, and it is the work of the earth, that this is the time of transforming this decay. And so that's what you were reading is from the I Ching, is that the judgment is that this work has supreme success. It furthers one to cross the great water before the starting point 3 days, after the starting point 3 days. And I'm writing a book on that now. The title of this book is Becoming Anubis, An Answer to the Corruption of Our Time. And I'm really deep into it. I'm trying to really understand all that these visions have meant in that relationship to this decay and the transformation.
Tell me again the timeline, the years that these events started happening, because I want to make a comment here when you do.
The time that all of this started happening?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my son was killed in 1991.
Okay. And then your mother was killed when?
90.
And your husband in 93?
Well, it was my son was in late in 91 and my husband was early in 94. So it was, I think, about 2 years and 4 months.
Because it's so interesting, the time of, you know, Dean Radin and the folks at Noetic Sciences, I don't know if you know.
Yes, I do.
But they've been doing a research project on enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many people has it happened to? Where have these people been? What were their experiences? What was happening in their life before it happened? What happened in their life afterwards? And they've pretty much come to a conclusion that there are more periods of spiritual epiphanies that's occurred from the early to mid to late 90s than ever before in the history of time.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's certainly interesting. And you know, most of the people that I interview, I usually have only scientists and doctors, you know, research people on my show to talk about these things. And most every one of them that are doing the research in it has had some kind of a spiritual epiphany themselves. And every one of them, it all happened back in the early to mid-90s. Almost every person I've ever interviewed.
That is so.
So something's happening.
Something. And I feel it so much that we are, and there were other experiences even before my son's death, right after I came back from Peru, and I have that in the 10th chapter. That was, I believe, the last chapter. It was one of the most powerful experiences of, we were doing, two other people and I were doing a ritual for our children and the children of the world, and I experienced this, and I think the other two felt it. They knew something was happening, but I felt this powerful disc of light. My eyes were closed, and I felt this disc of light enter the room and hover over me, and it was just the most wonderful voice and saying, "You have called us, and we are here to be with you all three. Can you feel us?" It was very interesting, the feeling. You have called us and we are here. We are the light. We are the light circling around your planet. Your planet has called us and we are here. I suppose that was one of the most profound experiences of my life because the energy was so powerful and the disc hovered above my head and then just spiraled into me in the form of a woman and sang through me. And I knew, and just there were no words that told me this, but I knew that we would make it and that this was a time of tremendous transformation, that indeed we had called the light, which was love and consciousness, and that our own, as well as the universe's. So I think something very profound is happening.
Before these things happen to you, if somebody had have told you the same story, how would you have received it?
Well, that's always a problem. I was open to everybody's story. I was always interested in knowing what people had experienced, and I'd spent my life reading it and teaching it and talking about it. But I think the problem with experience is that there are certain things that we can't know unless we experience it. It's just we have to have the experience, and I think this, we all are wired to have experiences with the other side. I mean, that's just another dimension of who we are. But our culture has denied and rejected that part of who we are, and we're killing ourselves. But it is hard for other people sometimes to really even hear it. And because there's no model or paradigm in a materialistic culture to know what to do with it, is that it very often just falls out of consciousness. Either people are afraid, they disbelieve it, or they just don't know what to do with it. And then there are others who think, maybe that's possible, and then they are open for their own experience.
Would you agree with me that it's kind of like an orgasm? It's like trying to tell a child about an orgasm.
They
cannot get it until
right.
It happens. But if they would believe you about it, and just kind of practice it or be open to it, then they could move along their path a little bit faster. But it is real.
Yes, and it's one of the things that they can never know unless they do experience it. But they at least have in their minds an openness to something that they don't, that exists, but they just haven't experienced yet. But when we live in a culture that says, no, there is no such thing, and the academic world has been notorious in laughing people out of existence and ridiculing researchers who have come up with incredible things that our planet has gone through and that people have gone through. So that's a good way of keeping things out. And you would think, well, if it's something really interesting, why would they do that? And I think a lot of it is because of fear. And to keep the old paradigm is just more comfortable. They have a handle on it.
Yeah, Bill Tiller told me one time that when he started really getting active in his work and consciousness, fortunately he was a department chair, so they couldn't kick him out very easily. But he'd said, you know, my colleagues thought I was a heretic.
Yeah.
They actually thought that I had lost my mind and was going, you know, that I was crazy.
Yeah.
But thank God he didn't give up, because look where we are today. But still people tonight. I was at a party yesterday and was telling somebody about quantum mechanics, and I don't know how it came up, but somebody said something, and I didn't know any of these people. It was my boyfriend's party, and by the time I left, they all thought I was crazy. I was trying to tell them, you know, there's no mass on the quantum level, so thought is a powerful thing because everything is thought. And this one man just really got his panties in a wad, saying, you know, that can't be true. They don't know what they're talking about because science says that there's math and that's all there is.
Oh, and which science?
And I was like, you know, if you want to walk, let me just, I don't have the language, the vocabulary to tell you, but I can provide you with the resources. Go and educate yourself. And
mm-hmm.
He wasn't even interested in doing that. He didn't want to know.
No, there are some that are really so, it's like they have been cemented into the old model, and it is almost as though they would be destroyed if they tried to change it.
It would make them have to be responsible for their own life and the trouble that the world's in if they accepted it, you know.
Well, I think you've said something very important, because the old myth releases us from a great deal of responsibility, doesn't it?
It does.
If we don't see ourselves as creative and consciousness and love, as or anger or hate or whatever, if we don't see what we do as creative and powerful, but that someone else is calling the shots, then we don't have to have very much responsibility, and that's a much more comfortable place to be.
Absolutely. It's somebody else's fault that the world's in a mess. It's George Bush or somebody, but not us.
That's right. And instead of looking around the world and seeing that what is coming up to the surface now is reflecting something very serious about our species, and it's a part of us all. But that whatever we do, whatever breakthrough we can have in healing ourselves, we are also healing the planet. But that's, again, a responsibility that most people don't feel, and don't feel that we even have the power to do anything like that.
And I'll tell you one thing, and I don't know if you quote Fred Allen Wolf a lot in your book, well, several times. And,
mm-hmm.
I know Fred, and I had him on here, and I interviewed him one time. And the important thing about some of these physicists, even though they believe that quantum mechanics is real and that there's some kind of fluctuation that goes on in it, they still don't connect the what I call the field
mm-hmm.
as being something that can be changed.
Mm-hmm.
They it's like they have God on one side and quantum mechanics on the other side. Some of them still don't connect the dots and make it one dot.
Yes, that's something that sometimes we think, oh, how wonderful science. There's so many breakthroughs here. And then when we read on and see some of the interpretations of it, it's a little disturbing sometimes. I think that we need both science and the direct inner experience. And that's the left brain and the right brain. Now, certainly Fred Wolf has had some powerful experiences. I know that
he still hangs on to that materialism of the atom.
Yes, and yet he says, you know, that when the quotation I have in my book, he says, when we investigate matter at its deepest level, we find it dissolving into a non-substantial reality that religion calls spirit. In fact, quantum physics teaches us that there is no fundamental difference between matter and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, sometimes I don't know what he said, but I know that that I sometimes have felt, especially with the individual, that sometimes the scientist, and that's also a problem with the East, too, is that it's hard to accept the reality and the continuation of individual consciousness. Because certainly in a mystical experience, the paradox is part of its core being. There is the one and there's the individual.
Yeah.
And I think that's something both East and West are still having trouble with. But
they won't ever know the difference until, or understand it until they've had that experience.
No, I think
the orgasm thing. You just don't get it until you've had it.
And that's what is a big concern, too, I think, for all of us, and certainly by you having a radio show, you are working on that, is how do we build a context in culture that would nurture this type of direct inner experience?
One thing I think is we have to get on the same page about what we're talking about when we talk about that word, consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You ask some people that, and they'll say, they look at you like you're crazy and say, well, it's the opposite of being in a coma. And the other person says, well, it's everything that is. And the other person says, well, it's the difference between knowing you exist and knowing that you don't exist. So I don't think we have a meeting of the minds as to what we're talking about when we say that word. And as a whole, we don't know that we don't have a meeting of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ken Wilber's really working hard on trying to get something there so that we're at least on the same page when we use that word.
Yes, he is. Well, you know, we are in a kind of the beginning stages, I think, of scientists who are really breaking through to a different model of the universe, and then people are beginning to have many more direct inner experiences, and so in a way we're just learning how to dance with each other, I think.
Well, you know, Greg Braden, I didn't get to see all of this, but somebody emailed me these little video clips of Greg talking, and back in the early 90s, I don't remember the date that he said this happened, but there was some kind of thing that came into our universe that was some kind of light, like a some kind of ball of light, big, you know, as big as a galaxy or something, but measurable because they measured it. And at the same time that that ball of light, and if anybody wants to hear Greg talk about this, if you'll email me at evaher@gmail.com, I'll try to find this and send it to you because it was really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But at about the same time that this was measured out in the universe, was it the same time that everybody started having these spiritual epiphanies and waking up? Something changed. The frequency at which the universe vibrates shifted just a little bit if the numbers changed. So something happened there.
You know, two really interesting things to say about that is that my husband had a vision in which Pishti said, we are sure that we can catch the Earth in this, was it ball of light or beam of light is what he called it, beam of light. And Ishvan said he knew that when that beam of light connected with the Earth, and I do think that that was part of what that one vision of mine
sure
was about.
Sure sounds like it.
Mm-hmm. And then I remembered later, and I even saved some of them, when Pishti was a little guy, he drew pictures over and over of the Earth with a beam of light coming toward it.
That's amazing.
I know, and I thought, I just took it for granted. You know, I thought...
That would have been about or in the early 90s, right?
Well, when he was a child, he drew it, which was, he was born in 71, and he died in 91.
Okay.
But then my husband had the vision with Pishti after his death in which he told him that they were certain that they were going to be able to connect the beam of light with the Earth, which would be very, very soon at that time.
We've got about 15 minutes. I'd like for you to talk a little bit about, you talk in your book about an understanding of consciousness in the zero-point field. I think you call it the zero-point field. You may call it something else. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't remember exactly. Was it when I was talking about Eleusinian mysteries, or
let me see if I can find it. You can talk about something else if you want to for a second while I see if I can find this.
Well, okay, while you're looking for it, I'll just mention to run back quickly to the I Ching when Ishvan had that vision. I asked him, how did you remember that it was straight, broken, broken, straight, straight, broken? And he said, oh, that's easy. The code is ML. The first line of M is straight, and then there are two broken ones, and then a straight one, and then a straight one in L, and the broken one that's lying down with the other piece of the L. Well, I thought, well, that's really quaint. How in the world did he ever come up with that? But
I'm not sure I understand it. I've never read that book. Can you explain it a little bit better?
Well, this doesn't appear in the I Ching, but when I'd said, well, how did you know, how did you remember the lines?
What are you talking about when you say the lines?
The I Ching is made up of hexagrams, 64 hexagrams.
Okay.
And they're straight and broken lines. And it was actually the ancient Chinese book of science, or they call it the Book of Changes. And they really were very aware of the nature of change in our lives. And so a person could throw yarrow stalks or koans and which six times, and then you would get the hexagram, and the hexagram would relate your situation. Well, in this case, Ishtvan simply had this in a vision. Pishti said to him, look up in the I Ching. And Ishtvan said, too, we have it, you know. But it was when he said the lines are straight, broken, broken, straight, broken, he said he remembered because the code for that hexagram from Pishti was ML. And I said, well, what in the world is that? And he said, well, ML stands for many things. It's merchants of light who are coming to the earth. It's miracle lovers, the matrix lovers, just multi-lives, memory of light, masters of light. And he said the ML really reflects this new energy that is coming in this beam to the planet. And he said that the jackal healers, that people who we can take in this darkness and transform it into light, are merchants of light. And this is what he said, because they are able to distill darkness into light, and like merchants, they sell their knowledge of this process for the price of consciousness, and the entire universe profits.
Well, you know, that's kind of, something just dawned on me when you said that. If you think about that from the perspective of duality, to whatever degree there is one thing in duality, negative energy,
mm-hmm.
or there has to be the exact opposite of positive. And if, you know, David Hawkins says that every single person that has a spiritual epiphany and has an enlightenment experience
mm-hmm.
can carry the energy of 10,000 conscious souls to raise the resonant frequency of the Earth's hologram.
Mm.
So that would make a lot of sense if for every big form of negative energy, every person that became enlightened could take that large form of negative energy and turn it into the same degree or more of positive energy. It would shift the ratio of our electromagnetic field to the same degree by just one person.
Does
that make sense?
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Because it has to be that way in duality, you know. It just has to be. Energy gives and takes.
That's right.
Here's what I was talking about. You call it the vacuum. I call it the zero-point field.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you wake up, or your husband, what kind of understanding did you have about the vacuum?
Well, that creativity is constantly springing forth from nothingness. And I think that I had quoted probably Brian Swim when he says, you know, that the vacuum is everywhere, even where there are no atoms, no elementary particles. It's just constantly coming into being. He said, I'm asking you to contemplate a universe where somehow being itself arises out of a field of fecund emptiness. And this is the same principle that indigenous cultures and ancient pre-classical religion, the prehistoric religion, was that out of death comes life, that the root of being, they would say, is non-being. And so they understood that very well. What the physicists, I think, are talking about in the quantum vacuum or the zero-point field is that it's what we call fecund emptiness or emptiness or vacuum, but it is so the potential is absolutely powerful for life. Life is coming out of it all the time. And I think it's so interesting that the ancients would say the root aspect of being is in non-being, and Brian Swim would say that out of this field, life is arising constantly, and the field is fecund emptiness.
Yeah.
There is just no death. I have on the front of the book that there is nothing but life, and to experience this essential truth is to experience the miracle of death. And that's exactly what Brian Swim is talking about,
yeah.
I think.
And I think life really only starts when you experience death.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about that in one of your son's dreams. He was before, you know, the dream that you had before he was born.
Yeah.
That you saw his light there, and then his light had to enter the death room or the death door, which was really what we would consider the door to life.
Yes, I was pregnant when I had that dream, and I, in those days, we didn't know whether we were going to have a boy or a girl, but I saw a young man coming in at the bottom of a mountain, and it was dark, and he was to go through the gate for him of death, but for me, on my side, it was life. And he was carrying something on his back, sort of like Pilgrim's Progress. He was carrying like a sack on his back, and he walked just a short distance, and then he immediately turned left and started walking up the mountains very fast and went out the same side at the top in bright light. So I feared that that dream meant that he might not live long, but then I had a way of looking at that in another way, too. But, yes, that gate, that was another way of saying the death and birth is a transformation. It's a birth into another dimension. When he was born here, he died to that one, but he came into this one, and then he went out and was born again into the other dimension. So yeah, I love that dream. Afterwards, when I could look at it without being afraid, that it really does present a beautiful symbol of death as birth.
You talk another time in there, something that I could relate to. In fact, I had a conversation with a friend of mine named Steve Anderson. He's actually hosted my show a couple of times for me in the last couple of months to give me a break. But both of us have had an experience of, it's hard to describe it, being one with the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And we were comparing notes as to when we had it. It was kind of like having a near-death experience without having to die.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have a body. We didn't have any eyes or anything either, but we could see everything, but there was nothing of us to exist. Even though we had no body, we could still see and know everything as if we really had eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember where you talked about that? Somebody asked him, could they see when they died?
Oh, yes, that was a dream I had before he died. And as I said, when I looked back at my journal, I saw I'd been dreaming in various ways about his death for 2 years. Yes, we were looking at artwork of monuments. I had been very moved when I was in Athens in the museum looking at the monuments of families saying goodbye to someone who was dying. And so we were looking at these, and then suddenly we were inside one. And
you thought you were inside one?
Yes,
it seemed being inside.
Yes, that we stepped inside it from the back, and then it seems that yes, Pishti then was talking. They asked him, and I can't remember exactly where that is and the exact words that he said, but the idea was that, well, if you see on this side, you will see there.
Right. And that's exactly what it was. I mean, for both of us to have that same experience of not having a body,
mm-hmm.
but we could still see.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing.
Yeah, that's a wonderful experience to... I think, too, you know, that when we have the experiences like that, knowing that we are present but without a body, that we see without eyes, that when we have those experiences, they change us, don't they? I mean,
yes.
We know, I would, in the experiences that I had no question that it is our consciousness, our love, that energy that creates the universe, and that was the root, the core of our being. But that comes just from experience. You know, there's no way that one can quite explain that either.
Do you have a website, Betty, so people could find you?
Yes, it's www.kamlak.com. You can see that the ML is the very center of that word.
Mm-hmm.
KAMLAK.com.
and your email's on there and where they can find your book.
Yes, yes.
It's a very interesting book, especially if you've had some death to go on in your family that you're having a hard time to deal with.
Yes, and I the one thing that I really have always wanted to communicate is that it isn't that just a few people have these experiences. It is in our nature to have these experiences, to be connected to people we love after they die as well as when they're here in the physical body. That's the very nature of our lives. If we love so deeply, and it is that love that will not allow us, it's not in the nature of love to be separated from the object of its love. And so what I would want to stress is that we're working within a culture that has denied us for a very long time, but every single person has what it takes to have the experiences with those they love on the other side.
That's true. You can't make it happen,
mm-hmm.
but you can allow it to happen.
That's beautiful. Can allow it to happen.
Well, I really do appreciate your coming on tonight. I was kind of shocked when I read through that book tonight. I wasn't expecting that. It's amazing. It really is. And I'd like to tell everybody, next week, be sure to listen in, because even though Betty's, I don't know if you know, do you know Roland McCready at HeartMath?
HeartMath I know about, but I don't know the person's name.
Well, Roland's their senior researcher there. Next week, we're going to have Roland on, and he's going to talk about something which really expands on what you've been saying.
Oh, I want to hear that.
He's been having a new experiment that he's been doing about the measurable effects of thought on the mass consciousness and what happens. And
mm-hmm.
I have no idea what he's going to say, because it's like breaking news.
Oh, it's going to be good.
Yeah, so everybody needs to listen to that. It's going to be something really good. So tell us one more time your book, the name of your book, and where they can find it just before we hang up here.
Okay, the book is The Miracle of Death, and it's on Amazon, or you can get it through the Comlock Center. Or any other, I think, it can be ordered from any bookstore if it's not there. So The Miracle of Death, and the website is www.comlock.com.
Thanks so much, Betty, and agape to you, my friend, and thank you so much for sharing your
story. Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it so much.
And contact me, because I want to connect you up with InPresence.
Okay, I certainly will.
There. I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Good night, dear.
Good night.
Agape.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.